Welcome to another episode of Conduct Detrimental, Dan Lust, joined by the one, the only, the original Dan, Dan Wallach. Welcome back, my friend.
Yeah, it's been a long journey back to Conduct Detrimental. I don't know when the last, I know we did an episode, or I did an episode last week you were absent from, but the two of us together.
It's been a while.
I think we have to go back to the 70s or 80s. This is like 80s. Mike and the Mad Dog reuniting, I guess, sports law version of Mike and the Mad Dog, getting it back together, and hopefully we'll get back on track. But let's start with an episode that's in our wheelhouses. It's perfect timing.
Well, before we do that, Dan, you've been out of the boat. We shoot the shit for a little bit, then we get into the tough stuff. Dan, you're going to laugh. You said, when was the last episode? I'm not sure when the last one was, but I know that our most popular episode of 2023 was an episode that you and I spent a lot of time recording. I think we actually recorded that episode twice, and that was the Pat McAfee Masterclass episode that we originally recorded with Matt Timpanic, and then we were not happy with the audio and the general structure, so we said, let's do it again, and shocker, that became our most popular episode. So, Dan, we are back. We got a comment. Some people turn off their replies. They don't read the replies. We read the replies, and sometimes the replies hit home and that we send the replies to one another. We're not going to read the whole tweet because it's not necessarily family friendly, but someone by the name of Ghost, I think you know who you are, basically claimed that the last episode, there was some audio issues, and it's in a quote, he said, "You sound like you're you sound like you're in the core of the earth." If you're listening to the audio quality here, message received. You can thank our friend. I think he's our friend Ghost. And we're going to make sure that the audio quality is tip-top every episode moving forward. And if we have a guest with a bad mic, we will shame them. I think that's fair.
Well, let's just hope that this mic works. It would be kind of embarrassing if this mic was not on and we did this whole spiel about Ghost. But we heard you, Ghost. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we're going to be doing a podcast. We need to be using the real professional mic and not just talking into our laptop, little mini mic, which sounds like we're in, I guess, the core of the earth.
I like that line. It's a good line.
Now we're at the center of everything. You can hear us no matter what state you're in, what country, what galaxy. You will be able to hear us loud and clear today.
I like it. Shout out to Ghost. Okay. So we have, I got a little FOMO when you guys were recording about Ohtani last week. So, I've taken a few weeks off, which is new for me, but as they say in the business, busy is good. And we have a nice deep bench that we've been, grooming, but I think we've been training these guys over the years to lessen our load, but sometimes big stories come into play and we have to cover them. And I'm sensing, Dan, for the next couple of weeks, you and I are going to be starting our reunion tour. And it starts this week with a hybrid of, we'll say, just gaming issues in general, legal sports betting, which is your wheelhouse, and then really current events, which I would kind of say is towards my wheelhouse and prop bets. Me as a degenerate gambler, I'm very into the weeds. So we have Ohtani, we have Jonte Porter, we have Charlie Baker's quest against prop bets. We got three very heavy sports betting topics, Dan. I think it's only fair that we start with Shohei Ohtani. When you guys recorded last week, I don't think Ohtani had spoke to the media yet. I don't think Ipe's full resume had been exposed yet. So I think there's some more analysis, some more meat on the bone, so to speak.
Well, I'm not sure that he did much of a press conference. It was one-sided. He talked, didn't take any questions. There weren't any, live video that was allowed to be, taken while he was in the room. So it was pretty much a scripted conversation. But I'm not sure the Internal Revenue Service, Homeland Security, or the U.S. Attorney's Office will abide by that limitation. They're going to want to talk to him, and he's going to have to answer some questions.
I guess here's the update, right? Obviously, most people know what's going on with Shohei. The season, depending on when you're listening to this, the opening day is later this week. Dan and I are recording this on March 27th, so there might be an update. We are likely going to have a very big guest on in the coming weeks, but we will not spoil that. Tisha Thompson, who's been a former guest of the show, broke the story last week. I think part of the story was, quote unquote, the cover up, whether Ipe lied to ESPN or whatnot, who had knowledge of that. The update in the story, there's really been two. So Ipe is Shohei Ohtani's interpreter. I'll give a quote here. So Ipe Mizuhara is the name of the interpreter. Two important updates here. So the story right now that, you know, Shohei's camp wants you to believe is that Ipe Mizuhara is a rogue actor and is stealing money, and there's some massive threat, a massive theft that went on. The cynic in me says that I'm not sure how you didn't clear Ipe's story, right? Ipe spoke to ESPN and Tisha Thompson for 90 minutes last week. Clearly had some form of media training. Clearly Shohei's people were involved in that media training. Clearly those media training was happening in English. And how were these two stories not synced? It seems a lot to me, and I think I'm in the public in this perception, that once Ipe's story was told to ESPN, some lawyer got involved, and they said, you know what? Let's actually concoct this as a theft. So two sides weren't on the same page. Now, the Shohei's version makes sense if you believe Ipe Mizuhara to be a pathological liar and is capable of going rogue at any minute.
Dan, if you're Ipe Mizuhara and now you're accused of this massive theft of $4.5 million, if that is in fact true, I don't think my first call, if I'm Ipe, is reaching out to ESPN Sports Enterprise investigative reporter Tisha Thompson. That's like the last person in the world that I call if I'm a thief to the tune of millions of dollars. I don't take Tisha's calls.
If you're going to take the call, you probably call a lawyer first, and you have the lawyer on the call. And he's acknowledged, but on the record, he has no lawyer at this point. He's not represented by counsel.
And nor does he have any financial, banking, or accounting training. And his skill set is limited to simply being being Ohtani's friend and language translator. And the notion that Ohtani, it was blindsided by, you know, 2 years worth of, you know, banking activity occurring outside within his account, siphoning funds to the tune of close to $4.5 million. I don't know how many transfers were involved, but even if you're Bill Gates, don't you notice that millions of dollars are missing when the statements come out, and not just simply because ESPN and the Los Angeles Times start poking around? You know, all of us do banking, and when we do wire transfers or any significant activity occurring within our accounts, you get notifications. And no bank that's acting responsibly is going to facilitate, a six-figure or seven-figure transfer when the recipient of the when the transferor is not Ohtani himself. It involves his funds, and the recipient is someone for whom 180 seconds of due diligence would have exposed him as a chronic gambler who declared personal bankruptcy. Well, that transaction easily should have been flagged and should have been blown up.
Well, let's. I guess it's important. We should touch things chronologically. And I know you and I have thoughts on the story that's out there, but at least the update is that Ipe Mizuhara is not who we thought he was. I think that's an important development that's occurred in, you know, the Los Angeles Dodgers, who were reportedly paying Ipe a near $500,000 salary a year. You'd think they would have done their due diligence, right? Maybe while we're talking about, and I talk about it in my sports law class, the concept of negligent hiring, they hired him to be his interpreter. He's on the Dodgers payroll. And it's come out this week that amongst at least two issues, I'm sure there are more, but the two ones that have gotten a lot of attention, in the media guide, Mizuhara, again, the team's media guide, is a team employee, is listed as having graduated for the University of California, Riverside in 2007. However, the university denied that Mizuhara ever entered the school. Quote, our university records do not show a student by the name of Ipe Mizuhara having attended UC Riverside, a school spokesperson told The Athletic. Now, it goes one step further. There are additional multiple media reports that state that Mizuhara served as Hideki Okajima's interpreter. He's a former relief pitcher with the Red Sox, and said that he was interpreter in 2010. And now it has since come out that the Red Sox are denying that Mizuhara ever worked for them or Okajima during this time with the team. There was also a statement, it's not going to be in this article, but that I think there was another report somewhere that Mizuhara worked as Okajima's interpreter while he was a member of the Yankees. And then there was a report that he never made the Yankees roster. So that was also legally actually impossible of having occurred. So Dan, to your point about due diligence, right, in terms of, you know, due diligence on the wire is one thing. due diligence on Ipe Mizuhara, other than being Shohei Ohtani's friend, which I don't think is in dispute, it seems like everybody missed the boat with this guy. And if, you know, to our earlier point, if you're trying to find the person, right, that is capable of concocting a $4.5 million fraud against their friend, someone that lied about their entire background, and it turns out we know very little about their true identity, that seems to fit the billing. So at least, you know, not necessarily saying I agree with Shohei Ohtani, but this person seems like a career liar all of a sudden. So maybe it's possible that there's some truth to the story. I'm just saying.
Or a career gambler as well. But, you know, you have to remember here that the Dodgers, it's not like the Dodgers, you know, picked Ohtani's interpreter. Ipe was part of a package deal with Ohtani. He goes back to Ohtani's days when he was with the Angels, and their relationship spans many years. They're best friends. I've read some Japanese media reports from, you know, interviewing people that said that he lived like next door to Ohtani, acted as a chauffeur, and basically took care of all of his needs. Most of his needs in a culture with which he was unfamiliar and didn't speak the language fluently. So on some level, this is really, this was kind of foisted upon the Dodgers, but all of the revelations that you just, identified, all the lies and fabrications from his professional background, that benefits the Dodgers because they fired him and it paid to sue for employment discrimination or breach of contract or something relating to the termination of his employment. The Dodgers can, you know, you and I worked on a case together once where you can identify other reasons.
Right.
That would have justified the firing of an employee with or without cause, even if you didn't know about it at the time of the decision to fire him. If you subsequently discover that, you know, there was some resume fraud or some, you know, malfeasance, you could tie the termination to that malfeasance, even if it wasn't part of the factors of, you know, which led to the termination of his employment. So I think his goose is cooked with respect to any action against the Los Angeles Dodgers. But I think we knew that anyway. Gambling problem, resume fraud is the least of his worries.
I'm not concerned. There was no part of me that had a thought that he had a case against the Dodgers. I guess where the concept comes up, you know, so I'm involved in, you know, in these corporate deals where we have to do due diligence if we're buying a company or doing some type of transaction. I would hope, right, and it's less a cause of action, more I'm just curious. I would hope that, you know, the Dodgers and their excitement of structuring this contract to be, you know, the biggest contract in baseball history with all these deferred payments, maybe it was small potatoes to them, this $300,000 that they were giving Ipe Mizuhara. I would hope that somebody flagged it and said, hey, just as an FYI, like, this guy didn't go to Riverside. We checked with the Red Sox. He never was an interpreter for Okajima. I don't think that ever happened. I'm of the opinion that they just said, yeah, well, Shohei wants a car. Shohei wants a Lambo. He wants his interpreter. He wants a sushi flown in constantly. Like, he wants, it doesn't really matter what he wants. Let's just give him all this and get this deal done. If the Dodgers did not know about Mizuhara, which, listen, it's for any other company other than a baseball team, a $300,000 annual employee requires some level of due diligence. But
background check. But I don't think almost all these like employment positions now with large companies, sports in particular. I remember like a number of years ago, maybe 15 years ago, the Arizona Diamondbacks hired Wally Backman, the Mets, famous second baseman from the 86 Mets World Series team. They hired him, and then all the news reports came out afterwards that, oh, he declared for, you know, bankruptcy several times, had several domestic violence incidents. And a couple of days later, they pushed Backman out before he ever managed so much as a spring training game. And I think ever since then, teams are very sensitive to, you know, conducting background checks on crucial employees. And if you don't think an interpreter for the best baseball player on earth, the most marketable face of the Dodgers organization, if you don't think that's a crucial job, somebody dropped the ball. I think you should be doing a background check just to make sure he is who he says he is. But I'm sure he didn't apply for the job. It was just part of a package deal with Ohtani, and they didn't really care. An interpreter is an interpreter. He doesn't have any real responsibilities with the club other than to be Ohtani's valet. And if the Dodgers had balked here, Ohtani wouldn't have signed with them.
So, you know, I think I can't disagree with anything you said. I think you're right. And I don't, this is my personal opinion, so we don't get a hit with the defamation lawsuit. My personal opinion is that the Dodgers did not conduct any background check on Ipe Mizuhara, because if they had done one, right, this would have come up very quickly. That doesn't mean it's okay. Dan, I watched a week ago this new Nickelodeon documentary called Quiet on the Set. And there was a producer, I guess he was a producer behind the scenes, a voice actor or a voice coach, dialogue coach named Brian Peck, who, you know, got a conviction or took a plea and had to register as a sex offender. So if you watch this Nickelodeon documentary, they said, oh, and, you know, once he took this plea to being a sex offender, he never worked again. Right. Wrong. Within, you know, 1 year of his release, he was working on, you know, the Disney set on Sweet Life of Zack and Cody as a dialogue coach there. So you could tell me, right, and some people might say, oh, he's just an interpreter. Why would you perform a background check? But that same excuse is not going to work well, right, if you put a predator on a children's show. So I'm not trying to make that comparison, but I'm saying here, right, in hindsight, the Dodgers are saying, well, if we put a degenerate gambler who's in debt to $4.5 million and is using Shohei's name to gamble, yeah, we probably shouldn't hire this person. We probably should have figured that out. So it might be a watershed moment on just this concept, which I'm sure has existed for years and years and years. Yeah, let's bring the best guy in and let's hire all of his friends sight unseen. Let's give this one a job here. Let's make this one the janitor. We'll make this one personal security. It's like, Dana, I used to watch that show Entourage, right? And Vinny Chase would walk around and, you know, he found a job for Johnny Drama and for Turtle. And, you know, like, yeah, I'm sure celebrity culture, you want to give the superstars friends jobs, but this is how it goes wrong in this exact scenario. And the Dodgers are seeing that play out right in front of us.
Yeah, I still use Johnny Drama's, you know, ask whenever, you know, he goes to a meeting and someone asks, would you like something to drink? And he asked, and he said, yeah, I'd like a Welch's grape soda. thinking he would always be remembered for that, because that's not an ask most people make when they go to business meetings. But I think the bigger story, though, is Major League Baseball initially was hesitant and maybe even reluctant to announce that it was going to convene an investigation. And that to me was shocking. It took them 2 days to reach that decision. What do you think the integrity risk to baseball, to Dodgers, you know, to sports in general would occur if somebody who's an employee of the team, very close to the best player on the team, was in debt to a bookie for an amount close to $5 million. Would you think he's a little compromised? Very compromised. And what wouldn't he do to get out of that debt? Would he bet on baseball? I mean, the storyline is that, well, no, he didn't bet on, you know, the bookmate.
Are we talking about Shohei or Ipe?
I'm talking about Ipe, if I missed
it. Shohei can make as much money. He's going to get out of that debt very quickly.
I know, but
stay on the active roster.
Yeah, but the investigation had to have been announced right away. You can't have an employee so close to Ohtani and you know, capable of, you know, sharing information with gamblers and perhaps even betting on baseball. You can't have something like that out there without properly and you know, performing a fulsome, comprehensive investigation. The problem here is Major League Baseball may not be able to control where this investigation goes, because they're not in charge of it. You know, the MLB will be operating or investigating on a parallel, separate track. The main investigation is going to belong to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security, the Internal Revenue Service, and the United States Attorney's Office for the Central District of California. Those federal agencies are conducting a joint federal investigation that will supersede and supplant anything that Major League Baseball do, you know, can do. And MLB doesn't have subpoena power over Ipe Mizuhara, or I doubt they'll be able to extract any kind of voluntary testimony from, you know, the bookie. I think his name is Matthew Boyer or something like that. So how fulsome of an investigation could baseball do when they have no access to some of the central characters, you know, in this alleged, you know, illegal betting scheme? This is going to be controlled by the federal agencies. And any assertion that Ohtani was the subject of a victim of a massive fraud, that's going to become unraveled rather quickly if that's not the case.
So this is where I want to add this. And you know, Dan, we're a good match for gambling topics, because you know everything about the laws of gambling. And I know everything about gambling. So that,
well, I know very little about gambling because my last wager on a single game event was during the 1978 or 79 NBA regular season, probably before you were born. I got into a 15-year-old gambling addiction where every loss resulted in my brilliant strategy of doubling that on the next game. And unsurprisingly, I lost 6-7 games in a row, 8 games in a row. And the losses, which were like kind of low level, they begin to multiply.
They do.
So eventually it was close to $1,000. And the bet that made me even Steven was a wager on the Portland Trailblazers to cover against the San Francisco Warriors. This was the days when Bill Walton.
I was going to say Bill Walton was probably on that team.
Yeah. Bill Walton was the starting center on the Portland Trailblazers. So what did young Dan Wallach do in 1978? Well, we didn't have ESPN. We didn't have the internet. What we had was sports phone.
I was going to say sports phone. Give me a second. I know my sports history. You're in my dad. My dad's probably a little bit older than you. But
yeah, my parents, you know, at the time, middle class, you know, economic type salaries, they must have been wondering why their phone bills were like astronomical. Well, I must have called sports phone 10 times a day. Anyway, that was the last time I bet on sports. And my expertise is more on the law of gambling rather than actual gambling, as borne out by my betting history circa 1978.
Well, I'm happy you survived that treacherous double down action. But you're speaking to someone that I think this was Saturday night, I was betting and watching Formula One while watching UFC, while betting on the Creighton overtime game. So it's a lot of gambling in my world, my day-to-day routine. So there was something that popped up that I'm not hearing many talk about. This is just the logistics of what was an offshore account and what in essence was a $4.5 million line of credit that was run up over 2 years. So from my understanding of what this bookie was doing, you know, obviously legal, I'm putting in quotes, no one's watching this video, but quote unquote legal sports betting, you can't bet on credit. You have to deposit money into a site and you have to bet with that money. You can't bet on credit.
Well, there are some states that allow you to fund your accounts with a credit card initially, but no licensed bookmaker will take an IOU and just bet on credit, so to speak.
So functionally, illegal bookmakers have done that over years. And that's when people's legs get broken and all this fun stuff that people talk about. Right now, the only way that a normal businessman, and I don't know anything about this guy Bauer, but in order to run a profitable operation, if some Joe Schmo, Dan, like me and you ran up an unpaid tab of $50,000, I would cut off this person's access and I'd never allow them to take I'd never take a bet from them ever again at 50,000, maybe 100,000. But the fact that this gambling debt got up to $4.5 million. Dan, Ipe Mizuhara is a Joe Schmo.
Salary, you know, to put a more finer point on the economics involved, how are you extending credit?
Correct.
$4.5 million to somebody making $60,000 to $80,000. Even if he was making $300,000, the numbers don't correspond unless you think that someone else going to be the benefactor of these debts.
That's my point. There's no way that this Bauer character, this California bookmaker, was under the impression that Ipe Mizuhara was betting. He must have been under the impression and probably bellied by the fact that the wire accounts came from Shohei Ohtani's account. My opinion is that that this person was under the impression that Shohei Ohtani was in some way directly tied to this account. Now, maybe it was some grand fraud that was committed, but that's why, Dan, to your point about the investigation, they're going to have to talk to everyone involved with this investigation and figure out whether and to what extent they had evidence that Shohei was involved with this, other than just, here's the wire account at the 11th hour in October of 2023. From having some involvement with this, I would think, you know, and just the gambling space in general, I would think that Ipe had to make some type of overt representation or maybe a phone call with Shohei, or maybe they met up somewhere. I have no idea. But this bookmaker had to think that Shohei was involved in, and why would he have thought that? That's where my mind goes.
Well, I mean, he would have thought that because he's taking action from Otani's interpreter. So he knows about
it,
Otani, and even if the losses get rung up.
Maybe that's it. Maybe there's more than that.
maybe the interpreter made, you know, statements that don't worry, you know, I'm good for it. Ohtani will take care of the debt. We don't know where the facts, what the facts are yet as to whether Ohtani even was aware of the existence of this. He's denying it. But that's what the investigation will hopefully focus on. You know, what Ohtani knew, when he knew it, who else in his orbit has the ability to, you know, have transparency and visibility over his bank accounts, his financial statements. There are a lot of unanswered questions, but you know, looking at it from the bookie's perspective, either you think when you're extending credit to someone making so little money and the credit is in the mid seven figures, you must have a pretty good idea or inkling that either Ohtani is involved in making good on this, or you have this incredible amount of leverage over somebody close to Ohtani that you could use that to, you know, I wouldn't say commit extortion, but to pressure the interpreter into providing the bookmaker with inside information about, you know, things like health and you know, stat playing status. There's a lot that a bookmaker or anybody who's part of an illegal gambling operation would want it, would that's like a veritable gold mine to have access to somebody who's closer to Ohtani than anybody else in North America. That's that could present a pipeline of valuable inside information. Of course, if Ohtani had any awareness or was involved in okaying the transfer, facilitating it, he could face exposure under federal law for aiding and abetting an illegal gambling business, for aiding and abetting money laundering, and even under the California Penal Code, there's a prohibition on bookmaking, which includes even forwarding money to a person with respect to a gambling debt. So there's a lot of motivation for Ohtani's representatives to disavow Ipe Misuhara's initial statement, because if it's true, then Ohtani, could potentially be prosecuted. They back themselves into a corner, and that might be the true story, that he was the victim of a massive theft, but that has to be the story. Otherwise, he's in potential jeopardy for either funding an illegal gambling operation or engaging in illegal gambling. This is the only way out for him, and he's got to tell the truth. So if he denies or refuses to speak to investigators, that's going to be a problem. That's going to be a major red flag, because if you talk to investigators and you lie, that in and of itself is a federal crime, making false statements to a federal agency.
I think just it seems like you and I are on the same page. We work with a lot of agents and managers. You know, once Ipe is speaking to the FBI and Tisha Thompson, and maybe at some point we'll get Tisha on herself to explain this. There was a conversation that Tisha reached out through Ohtani to Ohtani's camp through a spokesperson, and the spokesperson is the one that got Ipe for Tisha Thompson. Okay, and then when Ipe spoke to Tisha Thompson, this was arranged through some intermediary in Ohtani's camp. And even now, there Tisha Thompson has a report today, you know, when asked Tuesday to provide proof that Ohtani or his representatives have reported the theft to an investigating agency, a spokesperson for Ohtani declined to comment. So what I'm curious, Dan, right? Like, somebody at some point, I imagine, is in the room with Tisha and Ipe Mizuhara when they're having their 90-minute conversation. And somebody's in the room with Ipe Mizuhara, and then people giving him media training. That's an Ohtani spokesperson. So 90 minutes he speaks to Tisha Thompson. And I imagine for at least an hour, 45 minutes, I don't know how long you did deposition prep, 2 hours. So for a period of like 3 hours, nobody had the brainstorm to be like, hey, this is probably an illegal story that we're telling, that Shohei paid the debts off. But the biggest concern I have, which no one can explain this to me, if for 90 minutes, Ipe Mizuhara is just lying and making up, concocting some story, why nobody stops him at any point in time. So I'm missing something here, Dan. I think they probably should have called you before they did any of this,
They
but
didn't
now
have
we're here.
a lawyer. They didn't have a lawyer in the room to
But
appreciate the
they had a
ramifications
lawyer,
of
and they
that
had a
statement.
lawyer an hour after he made the statement. Something doesn't make sense. The lawyers had to have been involved beforehand. It just doesn't make sense. Because the lawyers are the one that called and said, just kidding, there was a major theft involved. Like, okay, so he retained a lawyer an hour after Ipe gave the statement. It just not. We're going to find out a lot more, Dan. I
That's why
hope
I'm
so.
so glad that the fact that, that federal agencies are involved in this investigation, because this goes back to a case involving Wayne Nix, who handled a lot of illegal, you know, sports wagers for professional athletes, and Matthew Boyer is like partly allegedly part of his syndicate. So this is an investigation involving pro athletes. Even remember Yasiel Puig was was indicted for making false statements to federal investigators and for obstruction of justice. This could all be part of the same overall investigation, and the federal governmental joint investigation is ongoing, and that's going to be the one to follow, because I think Major League Baseball has a self-interest problem here. They have a witness problem because they can't compel any testimony besides Ohtani. And they also don't want to see the result. And if it turns out that Ohtani was more involved than he's letting on, oh, they're going to have to suspend him. And this is against baseball's like best interests to have their most marketable player investigated by MLB and then sidelined for a significant period of time. I mean, I know the MLB, you know, folks who are in the legal department. I've encountered them before. They're going to doggedly investigate this, but there's an inherent conflict of interest because he makes so much money for the Dodgers and for MLB and the television ratings and live gate that it's helpful here that we have prosecutors, including the Internal Revenue Service, on this investigation, because they will look at everything and try to talk to everybody. And if Ohtani isn't willing to cooperate with federal investigators, that should be a telltale sign that maybe there are some cracks in this story. But I would tend to believe him, believe it or not, despite the entire 30 minutes that we've been talking about repercussions to him, that how could you go in that direction and be so emphatic about that statement? Because what was once a low-level crime of paying off somebody's illegal gambling debts, he probably wouldn't have been charged criminally, may have faced some modest discipline from Major League Baseball. Now you're telling a different story. And if that turns out to be untrue, then the cover-up may in fact be worse than the crime. And
I think so.
He may be facing more serious jeopardy, not only from Major League Baseball, but potentially from law enforcement authorities if he or his affiliates lie to a federal investigator.
Streisand effect, Dan. Streisand effect. Okay, let's we'll pause. We're going to cover this obviously more as in the coming weeks. We're going to stay within the gambling zone before we move on. A reminder, our podcast sponsored by Themis Bar Review, top bar prep company in the galaxy. So Shohei Ohtani's story is a global story. I don't think Themis offers bar prep in other countries. Maybe they offer like United States bar prep in other countries, but that's why we say the top bar prep company in the entire galaxy, because let's say you go to the moon, you go to Mars, and you want to study for the bar, I'm sure they would help you out. Okay. Two more topics we want to cover, Dan, both gambling related. Jonte Porter on the Toronto Raptors, I think, is a really interesting one. And then Charlie Baker will close with some college sports. So, Dan, the story, unless you're living under a rock, this was not covered last week on the show, but it's a very big one. Jonte Porter is the younger brother of Michael Porter Jr. He is some level of fame. He was at one point a pretty big high school recruit, ends up tearing his ACL in a game when he was a sophomore, and kind of goes into the NBA undrafted and is, you know, for lack of a better term, like a 12th man. He's like a two-way guy. He's a guy that really, if you never heard of him before, this story, totally fine. It's most people, I don't think, know who he is. So this season for the Raptors, he's played in 26 games, so he's not playing in every game, and he's averaged 13.8 minutes and 4.4 points per game. Why are we talking about Jonte Porter. I keep saying DeJounte Murray. We're talking
it's not DeJounte Murray. You know, that could be a future New York Knicks target. I would hate for
it
him.
It might be.
Eligible. That would be a bummer.
So Jonte Porter is in the story because of, we'll say new technology that is catching suspicious and irregular betting patterns. There are two games that is the center of an investigation in the NBA. Two games. The first game came on January 26th between the Raptors and the Clippers. In that game, Porter played 4 minutes and 24 seconds before he claimed to re-aggravate an eye injury, and he left early. So he played 3 minutes compared to his 13.8 minutes. The next game that is being investigated for suspicious activity came on March 20th between the Raptors and the Kings, and Porter's playing time was limited, and he left again early. He played 2 minutes and 43 seconds. And then, again,
pulled a Michael Spinks.
Pulled a Michael Spinks, pulled a Houdini, and just disappeared from the game. In both of those games, Dan, not that necessarily problematic that a player gets hurt. That's not really suspicious. The amount of action bet on Porter's unders for those games were the highest amount of action, according to some reports on DraftKings, of any bet on the entire site. So it's almost as if bettors knew ahead of time that he wasn't going to be playing that much, because why else would Jonte Porter's unders of every under, right, be it Devin Booker's unders or Giannis or LeBron's, people actually know, a player that 1% of the NBA viewing audience knows, everybody flocked to bet on him. And Dan, I'll give you a quote from
even DeJounte Murray. What would be more prop bets on DeJounte
exactly.
Murray? But maybe you're not aware of the fact that Toronto Raptors prop bets are the hottest thing going.
No, Dan, this is the quote from CBS Sports once, or from ESPN. One source told ESPN that multiple betting accounts attempted to place bets upwards of 10 to 20,000 on Porter props before the game. Quote, people were doing whatever they could to bet Jonte Porter props against the Clippers. And then just a few days ago, the same thing happened. We had a bunch of people trying to bet the under for more. So it's not all of Porter's games, right? Because sometimes he plays 13, 14 minutes. It's two of them. And in those two, people are flying into place bets. So, Dan, I will kick it to you. Are we going to see Jonte Porter play an NBA game in the near future?
Well, you know, all the controversies leading up to this over the last 5 years have been primarily players betting on sports legally in violation of league rules. We haven't really had too many or any situations in the post-PASPA era where there's doubt cast on, you know, whether an athlete was in on a fix. And in March alone, this month, you have the unusual betting patterns involving Temple men's collegiate basketball, and now you have the Dejounte Porter. I read that referenced in one article as like March Madness, but this is really the first time that we're beginning to see this on the professional, league level. And we don't know what actually happened here. But if you're going to manipulate and alter your performance for a payoff, I don't think prop betting is the way to go, because there are going to be limits. Sports, licensed sports books are not going to take six figures or high, five figures worth of action on an individual player prop bet. That alone would arouse suspicion and raise red flags. And then when you have all this action coming in, that's a very easy anomaly and suspicious series of transactions that anybody would be able to, connect the dots. You know, an inordinate amount of action coupled with player pulling himself out in consecutive games. And unless he was limping in the warmups, in full view of everybody, grabbing his leg, saying, oh, my leg. And then all the action came in after that.
Right.
He's going to have a lot of explaining to do, because if he was involved in any way, either because he was taking a payoff, or he told Confederates, this is what you should be doing, he's likely facing the end of his NBA career and potentially prosecution under various state or federal sports bribery, prohibition. So there's a lot on the line here for this player. And what strikes me as foolish is how could any athlete decide to become part of a part of this enterprise over a player prop bet, which sports books are going to limit, and which red flags and detection is going to be so easy. I mean, if you're going to do it in the Super Bowl, okay, I could understand, but a Toronto Raptors backup center prop bet, I would think is low hanging fruit for any integrity monitoring firm that, anyone would be able to point the finger at this and say, this doesn't look right.
Right. And to your point, it would be who else is giving the information other than that player? Like, for example, if you bet on, that the Raptors would lose, or, typical point shaving scandal, I don't know, it could be any one of 15 guys on the team, 12 guys on the team, the coach. But if it's only that player's one specific prop, and the two games in question where there's irregular activity, he leaves after playing 2 minutes, like that, listen, it's all circumstantial, but like, that's the most circumstantial you could get. I mean, it's laughable.
Here's the problem that he faces. He's already been you know, tried and convicted in the court of public opinion and in the media, but he has certain due process rights. And I don't know if he's necessarily guaranteed that.
He's not.
As part of an NBA investigation.
He's definitely
he has an obligation to talk. He can't hide behind any, you know, Fifth Amendment privilege. And the league may already have formed an opinion as to what happened here. So anytime a player is accused, or there's a suspicion that a player is involved in a match fixing or match manipulation scandal, the consequences for them are so dire. It's a career killer. Now, if I get jail plus career killer, and it's imperative that these athletes have, you know, a strong advocate in the players union or counsel representing them at every stage in the proceeding, because, you know, there could be an innocent explanation for maybe one of the games, both of the games, I don't know. But it surely looks weird. And, you know, he's going to need, he's really battling at this point to save his career and to keep himself out of jail. And, you know, some of the safeguards that are part of the sports betting, you know, regulations and the statutes don't necessarily include or guarantee due process rights for athletes or players within league disciplinary proceedings. And that in and of itself is a problem. This may not be the right case to test that, but you know, that's a disadvantage that any athlete enmeshed in a gambling scandal, you know, truthfully or allegedly, that's an uphill battle they're all going to face with their leagues.
Just for historical context, it looks like in the 50s and 60s, there were a couple NBA players suspended for gambling issues.
I'm talking about the last.
Yeah. I'm not.
6 years post pass.
Just for context purposes, at least 1966 appears to be the last player related gambling discipline. But of course, Tim Donaghy, you know, has obviously got his own lifetime ban for his involvement. But that's what the allegation is: inside information. And you know, we'll see what comes of it.
But you know, ironically, or if you want to look at it in a positive light, in contrasting and comparing the Ohtani situation with the Porter situation, legalized sports betting and the integrity monitoring apparatus flagged this. This is you know, an excellent example of why it's helpful for purposes of safeguarding and protecting sport integrity to have legal sports betting brought into the sunlight, and to have transparency and monitoring around all of the wagering activity. Maybe if this was in the offshore market, we don't know anything about the level of volume of bets being placed.
If we retrofit this to Tim Donaghy, and if Tim Donaghy stuff had occurred in the DraftKings FanDuel era, we would have figured out an issue with Tim Donaghy much sooner. But that all occurred in the pre-gambling era,
era. Yeah, but like you pay Miss Sahara. Donaghy is connected to a league as an employee or to a team as an employee. Those types of individuals would be prohibited bettors in any state licensed sports betting framework. So if Ipe Mizuhara, if he tries to open an account with DraftKings or FanDuel or one of the other online accounts, it should come across as fairly obvious.
Yeah,
Calvin Ridley. This is somebody employed by the Dodgers, and he'd never be able to do it. So these types of schemes involving insiders who gamble, they're not doing this, and they wouldn't be doing this in legal regulated markets because they'd never be able to get a bet down.
Yeah, no, I just mean the mechanism to flag suspicious betting patterns. But one of my friends over at US Integrity, those guys have flagged that, be it with Temple. I talked to my class about it earlier this week, the Temple basketball saga, which you mentioned. They were a heavy amount of bets being placed on weekday Temple basketball games. And I think in one instance, the Temple spread moved 10 points when there were no injuries or no other suspicious things. It was just volume. So yes, Dan, you're right.
This has been happening even before the advent of expanded legal sports betting. One of the most famous scandals from the mid-90s was Arizona State and the point shaving scandal involving Hadake Smith, their leading scorer. And it involved three games. And in the third game, the line moved like close to double digits. So there were some parallels between Temple and Arizona State. I mean, it's just the way that these things can be detected by having integrity monitoring and by having some visibility into the betting markets.
Yeah, I'm with you. So we'll monitor both of those just for reference. Jonte Porter has not played since the suspicious game was March 20th. He played a game on March 22nd, but he has not played since then. So he's been inactive. So it's allegedly it's because of an injury, but I think we all know what it is. Okay. Last but not least, third gambling issue and third and final topic. Speaking of prop bets, Charlie Baker is on the hunt to end college-related prop bets. So, quote from Charlie Baker, "This week we will be contacting officials across the country in states that still allow these bets and ask them to join Ohio, Vermont, Maryland, and others and remove college prop bets from all betting markets. The NCAA is drawing the line on sports betting to protect student-athletes and to protect the integrity of the game. Issues across the country these last several days show there's more work to be done." Obviously referencing Otani and Porter. So, Dan, Charlie Baker has been unsuccessful really doing anything on the NCAA front. He's been kind of I'll call him a lame duck president because he hasn't really gotten much of anything accomplished. Some big ideas, but not much has gone on. Dan, what do you think about the crusade to end college sports prop bets?
Well, I mean, the college conferences and the presidents have always lobbied state legislatures to either outright prohibit betting on collegiate sports or to ban betting on the games involving in-state colleges. And, there hasn't been much success legislatively for the college stakeholders, other than maybe a few states have limited in-state wagers on college games or prop bets. But maybe that's a good idea. But I think the gambling industry or the licensed gaming industry would be reluctant to open the door to having some kind of a pulling back of the ability to wager in college sports, because it's not going to end there. If there are more scandals or more suspicious activities, it's easily foreseeable that that conferences or maybe the NCAA will push for a broader ban on collegiate wagering. So if you open the door to allowing a ban on prop bets, is it going to end with prop bets? I don't think it's that controversial of a premise to ban prop bets, but will it stop there? And and it should be left up to the states. But the problem with some states allowing it, some states prohibiting it, is you're just driving the gambling activity to neighboring states or to other states. So unless all states allow it or all states ban it, it's just simply going to reallocate the activity to those markets which allow it. Which, when you think about it, in the long run, when you consider all these scandals or controversies beginning to pick up steam, the danger for the regulated sports betting industry, which has enjoyed regulation under a state framework, is that we begin to maybe run the risk that the federal government will want to regulate sports wagering and implement national uniform standards that are applicable from state to state. I'm not saying that that's where this is headed, but with these scandals or controversies accumulating, and if it turns out that Otani was involved in illegal gambling, I don't think that casts any negative light on the legal regulated sports betting market, because all this betting took place in unregulated, illegal offshore markets, or at least illegal markets. So I think the more attention that these athlete controversies generate, you may begin to see members of Congress taking a harder look at this.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you. I don't really have a strong stance on whether I think prop bets should be banned in college. Especially, Dan, as we spoke about, this is not the point. I mean, I understand the point shaving scandals, the most famous ones. You mentioned Arizona State. I know there's a very famous ESPN 30 for 30 on Boston College. This happened in the past. So I understand why college in particular is pretty sensitive to betting issues. But then again, Dan, we just talked about it. Prop bets on individual players seem to be the easiest ones to detect. And if we're just seeing what happened with Jonte Porter, you would be insane to manipulate or give anybody inside information on your odds.
That's right. That's right. You probably want to see wagering on individual player prop bets, because now you have the audit trail, you have detection tools, you have transparency around it. I mean, more eyeballs on this are better than less eyeballs. And You know, how could you end up shunting this activity to illegal markets or to neighboring states? Because if unless every state bans it, the action is going to be available somewhere.
Yeah, maybe Baker should call us up, because if you ban college prop bets, it's only going to, you know, we're not going to be able to detect it as easy if it's on those side markets. So to your point, Dan, you put everything on the up and up. If you allow these companies like US Integrity, I'm sure there are other companies, but, you know, I'm a little bit partial to them, but they seem to do a good job at flagging these suspicious betting patterns, be it UFC, be it in college baseball. If they see irregular activity based on past betting practices, they flag it. And Jontay Porter might be the, you know, the deterrent that anybody needs to see. I don't think he'll be heard from again. And maybe we could be wrong, but I highly doubt it. But playing in the NBA, Dan, is a privilege. It's not a right. Playing in college is a privilege. It's not a right. And if you abuse that discretion or abuse that privilege, you're not going to be heard or seen from again. Just go back and look at the histories of baseball, be it Pete Rose or those guys in the NBA or right, Paul Hornung or the Black Sox, right? There's, you know, eras and decades of this past practice. And, you know, if you get caught gambling on your sport, that's it. You know, you don't get another shot.
Yeah, I mean, we're just starting at the this is the advent of legal sports betting throughout the United States. So there are a lot of slip ups, and much of it can be cured through, you know, education and better monitoring. I mean, there's no simple solution. But I think the detection of all these anomalies in some way is supportive of the notion that having legalized sports betting does more to ferret out these, you know, corrupt or unusual types of, you know, wagers and the underlying activity that goes to the players themselves. You want to know, you want to have this kind of transparency. So it would be naive to think that, no one is going to fall or get caught in the crosshairs of these types of illegal wagers. But now for the first time, you have the ability to detect them on almost a national scale. But what's missing is an integrated national framework through which all the bets on a national basis can be funneled through some type of, portal or integrity platform. Right now, everything is on a state by state level. And that's not nearly as efficient if you had an integrated portal through which all bets and wagers could be analyzed, in real time or close to real time. But we're getting there. This is going to take a number of years to kind of smooth out the system, and legalized sports betting is here to stay. So is collegiate sports betting, but the states and the stakeholders are not doing themselves any favors with more of these controversies, because it could lead to Congress potentially weighing in at some future date.
Okay. I think that's a good place to end it, Dan. We just made it under the 60-minute mark. So Dan, appreciate jumping back on the horn with your old putty, Dan. And I think we should do more of this, Dan. I enjoy talking to you. I enjoy shooting the shit and spend an hour of my week with you. I do.
Well, I'm heartened to hear that. And I'm feeling very emotional now. I will double down in betting term, but I'll resolve to be back on Conduct Detrimental more frequently. And I've been a little remiss in doing that. And part of it stems from the fact that my son was just born.
Don't give me an excuse of children, Dan. I don't give you that one.
This boy? He's like a wrecking crew.
Crew. You don't get to use the kid's excuse.
Wrist is sore. My foot is almost broken.
Your interpreter just interpreted the schedule wrong. He was just giving you false information left and right.
All right. Well, we'll do this again. I promise. And maybe I'll get back into the rotation a little bit more. And certainly over the next few weeks, I think I'll be back for a few of the upcoming episodes.
I'm sensing the gambling issues have piqued your interest. So it's all good, Dan. We will be back. I might be away next week in Disney with the kids, but I'm happy with Mike and Taryn and other Mike K, Mike L, been holding down the fort. So you'll get some combination of all of us. But for the big topics, Dan Wallach and I are always going to have you covered. And that'll do it for us here at Conduct Detrimental. For Dan Wallach, myself, and all of us here, we will see you next time on another episode of Conduct Detrimental.